This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Paul Bingham. We're going to be discussing Aleister Crowley. Paul, it's great having you on the show.
It's great to be back, Robert.
And I'm also joined here with Alex von Goldstein.
It's great to be on with you guys, and Paul, haven't spoken to you yet, so I'm looking forward to speaking with you today.
Likewise, Alex. It's a privilege to be on the show.
As far as Aleister Crowley goes, there's a lot of kind of perceptions about him, and this image of him, especially kind of that on the whole conspiracy theory angle of like the populist right, a lot of people in the populist right kind of dismiss him as either just a degenerate libertine. Some people call him a Satanist. Some people say that he's part of like the New World Order and the Illuminati. And then on the other hand, I think the 60s counterculture, they kind of latched on to like his imagery. But people haven't really analyzed his ideas in depth that much. I've been looking for some writings. I have found there Kerry Bolton over at Countercurrents did an excellent series on his ideas. I know Keith Preston, in our latest interview with him in his book Thinkers Against Modernity, had a chapter on Crowley. Then also there's this site that's kind of a troll site, Aleister Crowley 2012, like a kind of a joke president troll campaign, but it does have like this listed sort of like a political platform of his ideas.
There's also some James J. O'Meara on Crowley that's kind of interesting. And isn't there that guy, Richard B. Spence, who's not the other Richard B. Spencer, but he's just Spence, and he wrote the spy novels about Crowley? Is that...
I haven't read those, but I'm familiar with them.
Paul,
I read it quite a while ago. I can't even remember the gist of what I read, but I do remember reading something by Spence on Crowley. In any case, the interesting thing about Crowley from beginning to end is that Crowley was fascinated by power structures in the world of his time and the future power structures, and he was also very into personal freedom and even pushing the limits of personal freedom. But at the same time, he recognized that not everyone was into freedom and the pursuit of freedom, the pursuit of liberty, and pushing the boundaries as much as he was, just as not everybody was into mountain climbing the way he was. And achieving those goals was a limited franchise. So in other words, he devolves from the left in that he does not believe that he's not an egalitarian at all, but he devolves from the right and from the free market in that he is both amoral or certainly not a conventional moralist, and he is not a free market liberal. So he falls very much into his own category, but in many ways he transcends a lot of the contemporary political nuances because, again, he was into power and he recognizes that the forms of power are not necessarily power itself. The party politics of today that we get sucked into are not actual power. They're just forms of power, just as the monarchy in England is not the actual power in England. So the political parties in the United States and other Western democratic countries are not the actual ruling authorities. And Crowley recognizes this. So he kind of moves beyond contemporary politics into a realm that not many people want to deal with, and that's why so many different types of people can claim him. The 60s hippies, countercultural movement, there's figures like Evola and the traditionalist right that have found him fascinating.
Have you read Evola's writings on Crowley?
Evola's writings on Crowley are very carefully done because Evola basically views him as a very interesting individual, and he kind of treats him very tentatively as a subject because I don't believe Evola was as advanced a Freemason as Crowley. And so he understands there's a lot you don't understand about Crowley in the first place because unless you're a Freemason and pretty high up, you don't have a clue what he's talking about a lot of times because a lot of the things that he goes into are, unless you have a background in Freemasonry and understand double and triple meanings, then you're not going to quite comprehend what he's going into. So Evelyn's work on him is very tentative, and I hope we can talk about that a little more as we get into the subject. But here's an example of just one of the different schools of thought that have analyzed Crowley or without embracing him. Though some individuals kind of openly embrace him, but that's taking him at face value. To embrace Crowley at any level is to take him at face value, and to take him at face value is to misunderstand his higher points and his, you know, his the subtextual points.
I think Crowley was speaking to future audiences rather than the people in his time. Because at his time, there was not really a mass movement that evolved around his ideas the same way there was around a lot of Marx, like Marxism or these different right-wing and traditionalist or even fascist movements. And he kind of, he has his ideology and thinking is so unique, as you said. He kind of exists out of the like a liberal traditionalist axis. He rejected like modern liberalism, but at the same time, he wasn't a traditionalist either. Keith Preston, in his book, described him as an aristocratic individualism, and aristocratic individualism. I mean, I subscribe to that philosophy as well, and to a significant degree.
I would say that I do as well, and I would imagine Paul might too. I think it's something that creative people, if you're like an artist, I think in a lot of ways you are an aristocratic individualist. Would you say you are one, Paul?
Yeah, to some extent or another. You know, this goes for Crowley. This is the basis of Crowley's whole thought. The end of all of my political thought is the advancement of my greater freedom and greater good. And that's what begins and ends for Crowley. It all begins with him, his own benefit, his own individualism. In many ways, you could make the connection between Crowley and Max Stirner. There's a lot of Max Stirner in Crowley's philosophy. Total individualism, but tempered by an understanding that you also have to make provisions for others to enhance your own freedom.
Yeah, I would say philosophically, I lean towards aristocratic individualism. At the same time, I'm also pragmatic in the sense I'm not a libertarian or anarchist. Like, there is a rule for the state in things like investing in infrastructure, protecting the environment, a national sovereignty, some degree of a social safety net. So I think the philosophy of individualism is different than, say, the political system of libertarianism or anarchism and just abolishing the state.
Robert, before we go on, I would quote a source that you and Alex may be familiar with, and that's Gornaher, GORNAHOOR.net, and it contains a number of writings on Crowley, including Evola's essays on Crowley, and it contains a number of writings on traditionalism and the Magus, and things related to Crowley, so I would recommend those who might be interested, check out Gornaher.net if it's still online. It used to be. I think their archives are still available if it's not there anymore.
Yeah, we'll put a link to it at the bottom of our show here.
And Crowley, basically, what I was saying about Crowley was, even though he had this kind of a individualistic philosophy, his brand of individualism wasn't about just letting everyone was the same and kind of do what they want in your kind of stereotypical like anarchist sense. It almost kind of reminds me what Rabbit said in our show, like a genuine freedom is not being able to do whatever you want, but kind of living in the society that you want, your ideal society. And Crowley did have a lot of different views. He was critical of capitalism and commercialism because he saw capitalism as creating sort of the rule of the merchant class as opposed to a sort of genuine elite, like the best creative types.
Well, again, one of Crowley's backgrounds is that he's very spiritually minded. And a lot of the current alternative rights point, and this is not a side point, but is that some people are genetically inferior and probably good for only slaves, if we get right down to the gist of the alternative rights point. But leaving aside the scientific basis, Crowley was a spiritualist. And so Crowley would say, some people are spiritually inferior, and that's looking from a artistic level, from the aristocratic level, they're spiritually inferior. They don't have the creativity, they don't have the creative spirit or what have you, and therefore they're in that same level as those people that the alternative right would consider genetically inferior. So Crowley is very much focusing on this group of artistic individuals that he feels should rule society. You'll find an expostulation on the subject in Wyndham Lewis's book, The Art of Being Ruled, in which basically he believes that the artist should rule, not the politician, not the soldier, but the artist is the person that best is spiritually and politically the best individual to rule overall, and regardless of what kind of government you have.
Crowley supported a social safety net, but not from a sort of a Marxist standpoint, or egalitarian standpoint. He rejected Marxism as kind of a collectivist group identity, but his reasoning for a social safety net was that it would free up like the creative types to pursue these greater things than just being kind of like a wage slaves. And you see that today as a lot of people are very creative as writers, artists, intellectuals, political thinkers, but they're not able to pursue their dreams because they have to work. And he did also put like a strong value on a sort of culture of a leisure, which a lot of traditionalists would reject as kind of decadent. Like there's a whole concept of like the Protestant work ethic, and Crowley would have rejected that.
Well, as I've observed to you before, Robert, most of modern traditionalism or rightist traditionalism is a form of LARPing, a live action role playing. And the thing about Crowley that's interesting is in all of his engagements, he focuses on ritual and actually engaging in practicing a lot of what he preaches, putting it to the test. So again, the right rejects leisure because supposedly you're supposed to be always working, but that's not a traditionalist principle. The aristocracy was supposed to have considerable leisure to practice its arts, to engage in warfare or whatever it pleased. And you had the laboring class that engaged in labor because that's what they were designed for, basically bred for. So again, when the traditionalist right attempts a critique of Crowley, they always come up with short because of their own hypocrisy, because their fundamental structure is based on a form of essentially cosplay, as they call it, or it's just as ridiculous as those individuals who the My Little Pony type people, when they want to embrace traditionalism, it's just as fraudulent as
there's a lot of correlation.
And even conventions.
There's a lot of correlation between traditionalists, people that read Julius Evola, and people that are into My Little Pony, that are bronies. I mean, I've seen Brony, someone named like Buttercup Dew was writing on Countercurrents.
And that's, like I said, that's going to happen because it appeals to people who like the live action role play. It's not real. With Crowley, you love him or hate him, he tries to push the boundaries of the spirit, whether it's by rite, by ritual, by living the lifestyle he lived, by drugs, by mountaineering. Whatever he did, he pushed the limits of his understanding, which modern traditionalists don't do. They never push their limits. They use traditionalism to justify their current lifestyle, whatever it may be, but they never attempt to push its limits.
Kind of is what the philosophy of futurism is about. It's about testing what works and what does not work, as opposed to doing the same thing over and over and over again.
Yeah, it involves trying out things that may be new, but they're not, you know, they embody the same principle. It may be a new invention, supposedly, but it involves the same principle. For example, the futurists embracing the automobile. The automobile just means speed. Speed means testing yourself and your prowess. It's no different than a chariot race. There's an old picture of an Italian motorway in which several motorcycles are pulling a chariot, and they're engaged in a race in Italy. And that's kind of what the futurists kind of had. You know, they take the ancient art of chariot racing, and they have these motorcycles hitched to a chariot. So it's the same principle of testing yourself, your own prowess, with a new means. It's just a new means of testing yourself, you know?
And he had this new religion called, Thelema, and it's something, it was definitely, I mean, I'm not really that big of expert on Thelema, but it was definitely inspired by a lot of pre-Christian pagan religions like ancient Egypt. He was brought up in a very kind of a strict Quaker background, so he did resent that he resented sort of his religious upbringing, and he created like a new, or I don't know if he created that religion. He did join up a group called the Golden Dawn, and then he rose up in the ranks of that. And also, he had this concept of creating a new Thelemic state, and he even wrote like a manifesto. He also talks about kind of the role of the individual in this Thelemic state, and what their social duty should be. But he was also a major critic of democracy as well. I remember when I interviewed Rabbit about Robert Heinlein, Robert Heinlein's view was that people needed to prove they were invested in a society in order to partake in democracy. And Crowley's views were very similar to that.
And that's the other thing about democracy in the beginning, in that democracy works in a society like ancient Athens, where everybody, all the participants are basically distant cousins to one another. And you have your, so they're all of the same basic bloodstocks or from a common ancestry, and they all have the good of their own family at heart. Their interests all coincide. So there's the pull of the blood, as it were, towards making decisions mutually beneficial to a community. And Crowley very much connected with that, in that he was very proud of his Scottish ancestry, or at least his Scottish roots. If not, I don't believe he was actually Scottish, but he.
Maybe you think Irish, because I know he was shunned by the English for supporting Irish independence.
No, he had some links to Scotland as well, and often dressed in Scottish regalia because of his interest in the clans and so forth. Because there you had the link to genuine democracy. The rule of the clans was as near to Athenian democracy as, you know, as anything.
if you look at a lot of his economic views, there's definitely are a lot of similarities to a lot of these ideas like a distributism and social credit. What is kind of ironic about that is just both distributism and social credit came out of kind of like traditionalist Catholic social thought. But well, they came from different angles, they came to the same conclusions about economics.
I mean, I do think that these alternatives to capitalism that aren't Marxism, things like guild socialism or social credit, I think that these are the economic systems of aristocratic individuals. You know, like Ezra Pound was a very prominent writer on social credit.
Well, we can go even before Ezra Pound back to Proudhon, who Marx hated in his lifetime. Proudhon was a socialist, but he was not an egalitarian socialist, and he was not even a he was very much in favor of dividing the French Republic into federal states, for example, and he was in favor of limited government, limited government form of socialism.
Is that mutualism?
No, I don't believe he called it that. He was actively a socialist, but his economic theories were embraced by the Charles Maurras and the Action France front in the early 1900s. So they were actually the first right-wing socialist movement to emerge in the 20th century.
And you see this trend with capitalism is it rewards the people who... Well, Marxists critique capitalism from an egalitarian basis, but the real flaw with capitalism, it rewards people who appeal to kind of the base masses, like think like stuff like Walmart and trashy reality TV like the Kardashians and all that stuff. And I know also Ezra Pound, he mentioned, he also advocated like free income and housing for artists. Because a lot of the greatest artists and writers throughout history to the present have been broke. Well, the people who become the wealthiest produce the most junk.
Yeah, and of course, again, we go back to the spiritual inferiority and superiority, because if you go and you have the rule of the wealthy, the rule of the capital, the wealthy will subsidize some real garbage in terms of art, architecture, culture, and social values, as we see in this day and age. The wealthy have no taste or capability of artistic discrimination, so they will embrace the lowest of the low in terms of art and trash and what have you. They don't have that appreciation for the finer things, and so that's why you have to have a forcible you have to have artists capable of imposing their will on the masses, and they have to have that ability to impose their will or their culture, because we go back to the Italy in the time of the Renaissance was a bunch of warlords subsidizing artists, and that's where you get Michelangelo, who was subsidized by a warlord pope and to do all this amazing work, both innovative scientific inventions and artistic work. That was all subsidized by and forcibly implemented by warlords. It was not done in the spirit of peace, and it was done in the spirit of violence, or it's made possible by violence. So Crowley was saying that the artist is the artist cannot simply exist in a society. You have to make provisions for that artist and for the support of artists. Otherwise, if you want to produce any works of art at all, it's going to have to be by forcible measures.
One other thing about Crowley is his spirituality did put a sort of emphasis on a connection to nature. And he was into mountaineering, and that there's something very spiritual about climbing up to the mountains or just being in that kind of setting. He supported environmentalism, but he still believed in the sort of hierarchy, like he saw humans as being a higher on the hierarchy than animals. But at the same time, he did endorse some form of environmentalism where people who abused natural resources and wasted them should be punished.
Yeah, there's Crowley again. You could create a link between him and Edward Abbey. Edward Abbey is not a tree hugger, but nor does he believe that the mass man should be allowed to destroy the vistas that inspire art, because the mass man has no interest in those vistas. He has no interest in beautiful forests or mountain ranges or sunsets. He's only interested, he would rather sit in front of his TV and watch porn. So if you allow the mass man to deprive the artist of those vistas that inspire his creativity, then that's going to inhibit the artist. And again, that's only possible. So you have to strike that balance. Yes, it is necessary to cut down trees, as Crowley says. They're not as important as human beings, but it's not necessarily right to allow the mass man to deforest an area just for the for his own benefit, because what's that going to produce? It's going to produce mass erosion, and it's going to produce mass erosion of the spirit. It's not going to benefit the mass man in the long run either. So that's the whole advantage of having a detached, aristocratic, artistic view of things, of allowing the all the trees to be lost. That the forests that inspired Thoreau, the Rocky Mountains, those mountains that they strip mined for coal to be cut down, it's in the end, it benefits no one, and it deprives the artists. So we're simply not going to tolerate the masked man doing all these things for his short-term benefit.
Do you see, are you familiar with this idea of the economic man or homo economicus? You know, it's like this.
Yes, Thomas Lovsunik's works.
Thomas Lovsunik has written about it, as has Alende Benoit in Beyond Human Rights. He talks about the transition from the Homo sapien to the Homo economicus. And I think Arnold Toynbee also refers to this idea. Now, do you see, going off from your last point, where do you see Crowley fitting in with this idea of, the homo economicus, the economic interchangeable man, the beast within with the homo sapien, of the kind of animal spirit of man? Like, where do his ideas fit in there?
I think Crowley, first of all, as a thinker, sees the world in flux. And he sees the homo economicus, that type of individual, as the type of individual who is in the process of being used. In other words, he's an actor at this time, used for a greater purpose by the corporations. In other words, in the past, the type of mass humans were needed for armies, and today we don't need mass armies, so we don't use them for mass armies. We need them as mass consumers. So no longer is there a need for a levy en masse, as they called it in the old Napoleon days, but we do need the maximum amount of consumers. But at some point in the future, we're no longer, the elites or the powers that be are no longer going to need those consumers. They may need the mass man for something else, but it won't be for consumption. But right now, the mass man exists to consume. That's what he's created for. That's what he does. And that's what he's meant to do by the powers that be. So he's in flux, in other words. He's being used for one purpose. He has been used for other purposes. And in the future, he may be used for another purpose. And so Crowley sees the potential in the mass man, I think, or homo economicus, to be used for something else at some point. Maybe it's to build pyramids or build sculpt works of art for, or, you know, labor for on the behalf of the artist. But I think he recognizes that Homo economicus is an individual or a mass type in flux.
If you look throughout history, great monuments were always built for a reason. In ancient times, they were built for religious reasons, from like the ancient pyramids of Egypt to the cathedrals of like the Middle Ages and Renaissance. And then today, a lot of building projects are motivated by capitalism. Even a lot of great architecture of the 20th century has been produced by capitalism. But the problem with society is that if building like monuments and creating aesthetics purely for a profit, there's never this case of building stuff just purely for to create these great monuments. And that kind of ties into we're having a hierarchical based society where you have a creative caste at the top.
Yeah, there's always a purpose for the mass man, but his purpose is constantly altering. And where Crowley differs from most traditionalists is that he actually feels that, or supposedly differs, is that the future is brighter than most of the traditionalist writers thought it might be. You know, in other words, he thinks that things collapse, but automatically, once they revert to the way, they will immediately revert to the way they should be once things collapse. In other words, there's not going to be some slow march to a golden age after a collapse. He thinks it will automatically happen. So Crowley, to a certain extent, actively promotes a lot of things that might hasten the collapse, whereas most traditionalists seek to slow the process. He is willing to actively push it along because he thinks things will immediately, the switch will immediately flip and the lights will come on and the Kali Yuga will brighten the world, as it were, not destroy it. So, in other words, he sees a use for the mass man in the future. He does not totally denigrate them and think that they have no future value or purpose.
What are your thoughts on Crowley's views about sexuality? I know he wrote this book of poems called White Strains, and it basically deals with every kind of a subset of human sexuality. Like there's a lot of sadomasochism, homoeroticism, just pretty much anything you could think of. Especially a theme, there's like a theme of like a power, but some of them are also like a romantic love poems as well.
Well, again, going back to Crowley was not into LARPing, as it were. He practiced all this stuff. And I see it under the same vein as his mountain climbing, in that it was active practice, a certain the sexual practices impacted his spiritual outlook and impacted the way he saw things and understood things, and that's what their purpose was in the long run, impacting one's understanding of both spirit matter and gaining wisdom through the various both sexual magic rituals and actively engaging in commonplace interactions of that sort. I don't understand a lot of those purposes, but I don't understand a lot of Freemasonic rituals and purposes, but the fact that we don't understand them, that we are not initiates of them, does not All I can say is I don't understand them, but I know it has some purpose, though I'm not an initiate. Because if it didn't have some purpose, they would not be practiced to this day. The Bohemian Grove we know is real, and their sexual practices are not just done for their own amusement. They have a valid basis. I don't understand that basis, but I understand that to them, it is not a matter of just pure pleasure. To them, they believe it has a valid basis and purpose. And likewise with Crowley.
That reminds me of what James O'Meara said in our interview in regards to homosexuality, is that both the left and the right look at homosexuality from a moralistic ground. One side, well, the right says homosexuality is immoral. The left says that homophobia is immoral, and that it's a moral imperative to tolerate homosexuality. But James's point was that you should look at things as, like, what is the role that this group and behavior has in society, rather than looking at things from a purely moralistic reaction?
Well, I view most forms of sexual excess as paraphilias. And I view paraphilias as rather like I do drug use. Drug use has many purposes, and the more intelligent people use drugs for various reasons, and paraphilias are used like drugs, essentially sex. They say sex and drugs. I say sex and drugs. I put those two for different reasons together, in that they can be used for experience. In other words, you experience drugs, or you're just addicted to them. You just like the feel of them, or you're addicted to them, or you like the experience, or what you gain from each experience that does something for you or your intellectual state. And this is why, you know, Crowley experimented widely with drugs. I think it was the same principle, in that he was furthering his intellectual state as well as just treating it as a vice. It was more than a vice.
Well, that's...
Basically, the thing is, a lot of this stuff, there's like the small group of people you're talking about, but for, say, the kind of like the conformist masses, like... those people, do you think they're better off under a more, like, stricter conservative morality?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Crowley never generalized his religion. Thelema, his religion, Crowley was not much of a religionist in terms that he treated his disciples badly. He did not proselytize extensively. And what I think his basic view is that this kind of thing is not for everyone. Just as mountaineering is not for everyone. It's for a select few. The rest of the people have to do what's best for them. And their own experience with freedom has to be within certain boundaries, because most people don't want to push boundaries. So most people want to experience freedom in their own limited boundaries. And to push them outside of those boundaries, as we do in this society, the media, the mass media, and other people pushes people way out of their comfort zones to do all kinds of depraved sexual acts and things that go against their normal natures. Now, to some people, that's not depravity. To an intellectual, to myself, I don't consider a lot of actions depraved that I don't engage in. But yet there are a lot of people who naturally feel they're depraved but engage in them because the mass media tells them to. So the mass media essentially forces people to engage in depraved actions against their will, and it makes them uncomfortable, it makes them depressed, it damages them severely.
Do they engage in these...
That's pushing them against their will, against their freedom.
Do they engage in these activities because they feel that they have a moral obligation to engage in these activities? Like, if somebody who is not a homosexual wants to show that they are tolerant, so they engage in oral sex with another man, they may do that out of a moral obligation.
I don't see that as an example necessarily, but let's just take oral sex in general. It was never a heterosexual pastime. It was always a homosexual pastime that eventually became adopted by heterosexuals. And so the common nature of the commonness of oral sex in this society among heterosexuals, it's unnatural for heterosexuals, and heterosexuals feel vaguely uncomfortable with it.
Yeah, that was even the case in ancient Rome. Philatio was sort of practiced in a homosexual stance where with one man and another man, but it was considered very dirty for heterosexuals to engage in philatio or cunnilingus.
Yeah, it was considered very abnormal. And to this day, I think a woman feels essentially depraved, but at the same time, she feels compelled by society to engage in it. So it affects every woman that engages in it fundamentally, I think. Now, there are a select few women always who will engage in any depraved act and be perfectly comfortable with it. But the vast majority are forced into it by the mass media and by common perceptions. So they're going against their freedom. They're being pushed out of the boundaries that they themselves, their minds naturally.
Well, I mean, I also think there's an idea of like dominance within sexuality, though. I mean, but as far as taboos go, I think things fluctuate through the years. Like, what is the acceptable form of domination, and what is the unacceptable form?
Well, absolutely, I don't disagree with that. But I'm just saying that Crowley's thought is that the individual should have freedom to exist within their own boundaries. And not everybody wants to be like Crowley and push the boundaries all the time.
He also advocated kind of like youth colonies for children who wanted to leave their parents. What's interesting about that is that's something that's always been kind of practiced by the elites, but it's not something that's practiced so much by the masses. But you could even make comparisons to like Hitler Youth or the left. There's like that leftist youth camp that was attacked by Anders Breivik. But it's very important to power, because if you want to have power in society, you need to have control of the youth. And that's, if you sort of have these like generational divides, which we see in our society, that puts the youth of the masses in control of the elite. And while you, if you have like a youth camp that provides an opposition to the power structure, and Crowley was very kind of ingrained with the elite, and he understood how they thought.
Well, again, you're not even focusing on general youth. You're focusing on that top 10% that is always going to be placed into camps and indoctrinated for future use by the leadership of any country or any power structure. And that's why in every high school in the country, you have a valedictorian, you have a salutatorian, and you have a top 5% of the class that is carefully monitored, carefully managed, and carefully steered into various programs to enable them to be leaders of the community. But they are groomed for this position. They are groomed by older people sexually, socially, and so forth and so on to fulfill these future leadership roles, but also to accept the influence of older leaders throughout their lifetime. So in other words,
the opposite of like the hippie mantra, don't trust anyone over 30.
Yeah, exactly. But again, the hippies were not, the hippies were on the early end of this, because it was prior to, after World War II, that this became ingrained in the United States, as the power structure began to actively engage in the Greek type of mentoring, in which they expected the younger people to carefully be controlled by the older generations, and it was a form of sexual, social, moral control, in which the older individuals dominated the youngers, and still do to this day. So you will have people like Henry Kissinger that are still relevant to this day, and you'll have a vast number of individuals under them who still listen with rapt attention to whatever they say because they're under their sway, regardless of the fact that Henry Kissinger hasn't had an original thought since 1976. He still is a power, and there are many other elderly people who hold the real power in the world today because they started with youthful acolytes and control them so thoroughly.
When we interviewed James O'Meara, Alex, do you remember what he kind of said about that topic?
About what,
how
the boys club?
How kind of the elites want to break down kind of the bonds. They want to break down like male bonding, but they also want to kind of separate age groups.
Well,
stigmas to kind of stigmatize that.
Well, what O'Meara was saying was that, you know, in the 1930s, it was like you'd have the gang of boys, you know, like the Little Rascals is an example that, you know, would go and hang out, and they would have a man who was sort of the Cub Scout, perhaps the Cub Scout master, or the Catholic priest who was the, you know, the kind of like grandfather to the group of kids, the group of boys. And now when we think of the Cub Scout master or we think of the Catholic priest, I think most people think of pedophiles. I think they think of pedophiles when they think of those two archetypes of men. Now, it's funny because I think I was talking to some normie about this recently. He said that he was dismayed that Catholic priests got a bad rap because teachers have sex with their students much, much more than Catholic priests molest. But we have to say that the teacher is good because the teacher is part of the state apparatus, and we can't vilify them as a molester. We have to vilify the Catholic priest as as a molester. Rob, was that on our show?
I think so, but there was some, I forget the name of it,
so
but there
it
was some film about like a British boarding school.
Okay.
And it shows like the older boys having like a dominant homosexual relationship in a hierarchical power sense.
That went on for
100 years, over 200 years with British boarding schools, and it was just commonly ingrained that you had the stronger boys, and you had their servants that they call fags, who the younger, weaker boys that served them, and that was a self-perpetuating system. Winston Churchill Jr., I believe, wrote, or Winston Churchill II, Winston Churchill's son, wrote extensively about this system, and I think he actually underwent it. So it was a self-perpetuating system. What I was going to add to O'Meara's comments is that Steve Saylor has noted that in the case of the Catholic priests, many of those accused of molesting the children or the boys actually played a passive role in the sex acts.
It was instigated.
Not meaning to be crude, but you mean a passive role? You mean like, say, giving, performing fellatio rather than forcing?
Yeah, exactly. And so that's
actually
point.
Different in, like, say, ancient pederasty in ancient Greece. It would have been the other way around.
Exactly.
What's kind of funny is that Milo Yiannopoulos has said multiple times that that he forced a priest to have sex with him.
What?
something like that. He was molested by a priest, but that he was the one doing the molesting. Now, while, you know, I sort of like threw that to the side because I just think he's a provocateur, and I kind of don't believe a lot of things he says.
There's always going to be that precocious 5% that are like Milo, who did basically get to where he is on his knees. All along the line, I mean, Milo just come out of nowhere, and he didn't just come out of nowhere, it's just because you didn't see him, because he was on his knees all the way up.
Well, the thing about that psychology is, like, forcing act is like an act of dominance. So let's say you had a priest who was to perform fellatio, that's more, I don't know if there's what their psychology is, I guess it's just act of like physical attraction, but there isn't that strong element of a dominance that you would see in like traditional pederasty.
Well, again, we're looking at most of the victims or so-called victims were virile boys in their middle teens who had very little sexual outlets, and so I think you could say that the priests who were passive homosexuals themselves were attracted to the boys' masculinity and were, you know, desired to play the passive role in their interactions. So again, speaking on this whole subject is that Crowley himself often played the passive role in his same-sex relationships.
Well, yeah, he was interested and he received, he played the passive role in a homosexual sodomy, but he was also interested in a like sadomasochism with the women who were dominatrix.
Yeah, there was, I would say, Crowley was very much of a switch, and there aren't very many switches. I think of, Max Mosley, the son of Sir Oswald Mosley, and I can't think of the prominent Lady Diana Mosley, I think her name was. She was from one of the very she was one of several sisters that embraced fascism, but I can't think of the Mitfords, I think it was. But Max Mosley was a few years ago shown to be a switch in that he enjoyed both dominating and being dominated by women. And it came out as a big scandal a few years ago. He was chairman of some prominent British corporation. And so it is fundamentally an Anglo trait, I think, but it's uncommon to find a switch. I think anyone will tell you, usually an individual is one or the other, a dominant or a submissive, and very few people are true switches.
Alex, you want to comment?
Wow. Well, that's a pretty interesting idea. I'm unpacking that in my head a bit. So what is it about Anglo sexuality that separates it from the sexuality of other Europeans, you know? Because I always take it,
predominantly in Anglo sexuality, sadomasochism is predominant in Anglo sexuality. It always has been. There's always been an obsession with dominance, whether it be in the same sex or heterosexual relationships. You will find it. It might be because of the British class system.
Yeah, yeah.
Or it might just be inherent in the Anglo character, but
there's a sense of order.
It goes back to, you know, the 16th and 17th century pornography. You know, you won't find that in Italian pornography or French pornography or the story of Casanova. It's entirely different. It's uniquely Anglo. It's not European or continental.
Would you say that a Crowley was like the original troll? Like we have this whole like troll phenomenon now, like examples like Milo.
I think Crowley was one of the very early trolls. Yes, of the 20th century, and I think trolling is a rational response to modernism. And Crowley was one of the first people to confront modernism with trolling. In other words, he was the first person, one of the first to devise the method of trolling to confront modernism.
Well, wasn't the Boston Tea Party a form of trolling in a way?
I think the Boston Tea Party was a viable form of terrorism. Because what you had, the counterpart to that today would be if a bunch of guys dressed up like Muslim terrorists and went to like a chicken factory and dumped all the chicken out to rot or freed all the chickens in a uh, in a chicken factory that were about to be butchered. That would be analogous to the Boston Tea Party.
If Crowley were alive today, what do you think would be some of his observations on today's society and his thoughts on these different political movements?
I think Crowley would be entirely disinterested in Western politics. I think Crowley would be focused. He would interact with the cartels. He would be fascinated by the new narco religions, and it would be he would have very little to do with Western power structures as they are. I think he would be more interested in forms of European culture entering in the third world or emerging in the third world. For example, in South America, the power structures are still very much white dominated, but by a different kind of whites or European people of European ancestry than we're used to seeing. In other words, you have like Mexico, it's a bunch of tall white guys running the country, and or the cartels, bunch of tall white guys running the cartels, or blonde haired, blue eyed guys. So I think, and the same with China, in that the and various other Asian countries, in that the tallest and fairest off or with some Aryan lineage end up ruling. So he would be looking for those power structures in the third world or in the Asian world that were still of European descent, and studying them and focusing on them rather than focusing on the dying European accepted politics, party politics and religions and so on, because there's just not much interesting going on in Western society right now.
Well, you know, some would say that these kind of this sort of rejection of globalism that's happening throughout the Western world might be an interesting thing. What do you think Crowley would say about that, or would he just dismiss it entirely?
I don't think Crowley would pay any attention to anything that was commonplace unless he could somehow profit by it. He would totally ignore the accepted, because when we realize everything put out in the Western world that we talk about is media smoke and mirrors, you have to look for the essentials that actually matter, not what the media posits or places forward for us to believe are the essentials. What are the actual essentials, not those things that labor under the guise of important matters. So he would be focusing on what's actually important in this world today, which really very little have to do with the Western Hemisphere. There's a lot going on again in South America and Mexico with the cartels' dominance, the narco religions. In Asia, there's the resurgence of fascism. A lot of stuff going on with Islam, and Islam is literally falling apart right now. Islam is literally disintegrating before our eyes, and we think the Western world fears Islam, and it's literally disintegrating right now before our very eyes. So, ignoring the contemporary understanding of things and actually looking at having experiences that would help him understand things directly.
Are there any modern thinkers today who you see parallels with Crowley?
You know, the problem with modern thinkers, and honestly, I know there are a few, but none come to mind just off the top of my head. The problem with modern thinkers is that they don't seek to have experiences like Crowley. Most people are, this goes back to most people are men are just who are interested in writing and thinking and committing their thoughts to paper, but they're not interested in actually having experiences or going traveling or mountaineering or doing things to prove their theories. Very few people in our societies are interested in proving their theories on any subject or putting their theories to the test. So Crowley, like I said, Crowley would be all over the place. I don't see anybody acting like Crowley. No one that is, you know, actually going public. There are people who are doing it.
On the fringes, like people you know.
Yeah, I do know individuals like Crowley, but they're not widely known or nor do they want to be known, because the world is considerably more dangerous these days than it was in Crowley's day, because a lot of these movements take their privacy a lot more seriously in this day and age, despite the fact that they have no regard for the privacy of others, nor do they really care if their movement is exposed to the general public, because the general public is incapable of doing anything about it.
Paul, we're getting close to the end of the show. I think for our next show, I would like to talk about Italian futurism. But before I wrap things up, can you kind of give a sort of introduction to our next show on how they relate to Crowley?
Crowley was very influential on the Italian scene because, again, everything new comes from the old, and Crowley was very interested in this, as were a number of Italians in the early 20th century, as futurism came to the front. And futurism was led by individuals such as Marinetti and D'Annunzio, who were also very interested in tradition, right, and Freemasonry. And they coexisted in this period in Italy, and they had a great deal to do with one another, because a lot of them were physical types who were very interested in actively proving their theories again, and very very interested in seeing the end of both modernism and democracy. They were embracing certain aspects of modernism, rejecting most aspects of modernism that are currently embraced by Western society. They also totally reject liberalism. So Crowley has certain interests that are very similar to the futurist movement. But at the same time, in that period of the early 20th century, there were a number of movements that existed. We might put them in the same tent.
Vorticism, like fascist modernism, Wyndham Lewis, that kind of stuff?
Well, Vorticism, see, that's exactly where I'm going, because Wyndham Lewis hated Marinetti and the futurists and actively heckled them personally. His Vorticist movement actually actively heckled the futurists in the 1920s.
I guess we'll talk about this a bit on the next show as well. We'll talk about Wyndham Lewis and Vorticism.
Okay. My point is, you can put all these people in the same tent today, but they felt like they were fiercely independent of one another at that time. Crowley, Wyndham Lewis, Marinetti, and the futurists, they all seem to have very similar views today, but at that time, they felt that they were very different in their appraisal of the big picture, as it were. So that would be my closing remarks on that subject, and we'll delve into that more in that future show.
Paul Bingham, I'd like to thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me, Robert.
And also, thanks, Alex.
It's been a great talk, guys, and I look forward to talking to you about futurism.